Hello and welcome behind the marquee, the podcast where we talk about what's going on within our art house community. My name is Nick Aldrink and I am the programming and media coordinator for the Michigan and State Theater. Today's episode, you'll hear me talk with Melissa Hazelip. Melissa is the director of the documentary Mr. Soul that's now playing in our virtual movie palace and in virtual movie palaces around the country. As you'll hear me say, this film has been on my radar for quite a while now, and I truly just believe this is a documentary that everybody needs to see about a television show that should be in all television history books and yet is not. And this conversation with Melissa really is one of my favorite interviews I've ever done for this podcast. Just a very insightful human being and a truly delightful personality. Once this podcast was even over, we just ended up talking for 20 minutes, and it was a blast. So I will leave it at that. I hope you enjoy this conversation I had with Melissa Hazelip. Hello, Melissa.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Oh, it's been a crazy day. It's been great.
Oh, that's great to hear. Busy just promoting the film right now?
Yeah, we have a big article that came out in the New York Times today.
Oh, so, I didn't see that. I'll have to check that out.
Oh, yeah. I'll put it in the chat. You have a chat over here? Let's see.
All right, there it is. Great. I can't wait to check that out. Thank you so much for agreeing to record the podcast. We're talking about your film, Mr. Soul. The Mr. Soul premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival and was awarded the 2018 International Documentary Association Award for Best Music Documentary. It's played at over 40 film festivals and won 13 additional awards. This film has been on my radar since it was at the 2019 True False Film Festival. I love that. True False is one of my favorite festivals around. I wasn't able to attend the 2019 festival, but as we have our own film festival called Cinetopia, and I was hoping to get it for our film festival, but unfortunately, just timing, it wasn't able to work. So I just want to say I've been looking forward to seeing your film and for over a year now, and let me just say it didn't disappoint me. I loved it. It did not disappoint at all. It was well worth the wait. So,
aw, thank you.
Absolutely. The film recounts the history of your uncle's television program, Soul. It ran from 1968 to 1973 out of New York City's PBS outlet, and it was described as the Tonight Show for Black audiences. As I was watching the film, it seemed there's so much love and affection for this show. So I'd like to know, while you're reaching out to subjects to make this film, what was the reaction that you got back from your subjects for the most part?
You know, what's really interesting is you always think that if you're going to do an historical doc, that you're going to have to dust off something, whether you're dusting off people's memories or trying to help them piece together where they were at the time, or you're unearthing history, or in our case, opening a vault of what turned out to be a virtual, what would you call it? A time capsule, right, of the era. But still, the thing is, what surprised me was how people's emotions about either the show or their emotions and feelings about that time period, or their feelings about their relationship with Ellis, all of those things were right at the surface. There was no dusting off any emotional response to the material. What I found instead was people were saying, oh, finally, it's about time.
Yeah.
We're so glad someone's giving this the treatment that it deserves, or, oh, your uncle's story is amazing, or he touched my life in this way or that way. There was also sort of a proprietary feeling around those experiences. Everyone held them close to their vest, or they were very proprietary about their emotions about Ellis. And so when I asked them to recount stories for either our pre-interviews or on camera, I was amazed by how immediate everything felt. And some of the subjects were very moved to tears, and were also almost reluctant to open themselves up that way, because clearly that was a very important time. It was a very raw and emotional and poignant moment, not just for the country, but for Black people trying to sort of reimagine themselves on this American landscape and trying to find their footing, you know, on the heels of the civil rights movement, in the midst of the women's movement, of course, the anti-Vietnam movement. So there was a lot happening, and with the assassinations that took place, it's not like I opened up Pandora's box, but I definitely realized that we were accessing a very specific cache of memories and very important feelings. And so it imbued the project with so much more immediate resonance. And I didn't take that lightly. I wanted to honor people's feelings about their experience on the show. And for artists who felt like this was what gave them their start, that was really significant too.
Oh, absolutely. Of course. I was so impressed by the programming of his show. And I was just in awe that I had never heard of it. What was on his show? I've never seen poetry like that on television before. I've never seen dance like that on television before. And I was just shocked that soul was not a part of my television history.
And I'm glad that we're changing that. You know, when I do talk about the show with people, in a way to try to describe it for those who didn't know about it, I say, well, think of it as the greatest show you've never heard of.
Yeah.
And if you have heard of it, though, it's a different type of feeling. It's oh, thank God, because I watched that when I was little, or my parents watched it, and it sort of took on this somewhat mythical, you know, magical unicorn kind of vibe, when really it wasn't. It was a real show with a real following and a real necessity, because it filled a gap that wasn't there, that had not been filled before. Yeah. So when you imagine this landscape of television, and here comes a show that just interrupts that altogether and takes away all those dehumanizing images that Soul aimed to obliterate. And it really presented the vitality and creativity of Black America in a way that no other program had done before. And I think that's what's still magical about it now. When you see it, you can feel that energy, and you can also realize that it was giving viewers at that time a real expansiveness of Black culture in a way that they had not experienced before. Because remember, there's only NBC, CBS, ABC, and then public television, whatever that outlet was. And of course, UHF, if you could get it to come in with your antenna. So there was a limited amount of options. And certainly people of color and artists and politicians and, activists, that had not been programmed before, to your point. So in a way, it made it must-see TV, because being on the show gave you credibility for these artists. But it also took Black culture into people's living rooms in a way it hadn't been before. It's hard to imagine that now, because we're so digital. Oh my gosh, there's so many channels, and there's streaming, and there's everything on Apple TV, you know, and all these options. It's just, but imagine when there weren't options. And that's what makes you realize that Soul was really quite special and quite high-minded for what they were trying to accomplish. You know, as you said, like the aesthetics of its show, what it looked like, what its goals were. You know, here we are years later, and it still seems like they were ahead of their time.
So were you around the show when you were younger? Were you ever on the set?
I was never on the set. I was way too young, but I did have the great opportunity to be living with Ellis at the time. He was staying with us. And so he used to bring over some of the performers after the show. And I thought that they were all magical creatures, you know, and I would crawl underneath the table trying to figure out who was, you know, who knew that it was, you know, I was bouncing on James Earl Jones's knee or whoever he had brought home at the time. Pretty special. A couple of times he brought over Malcolm X's children. You know, Ellis Hazelip was very close to Betty Shabazz. And after, unfortunately, Malcolm was assassinated, Dr. Betty Shabazz didn't want to go anywhere. And he encouraged her to come out. And he did bring her on the Soul Show once on the anniversary of her husband's. And also just to give her support and brought the kids over to play. So I'm still friends with them to this day. But again, I did not know that those are Malcolm X's kids. You know, we were just under the table like kids are.
That's incredible.
It was really, really remarkable. When I look back now, I realize, holy crap, that was a special time. And he was a special person. And it was the fact that he had relationships with people that really mattered. Yeah. Now we look at it as like, wow, what an all-star cast. But for Ellis, it was about what's the next best thing? And how can I give these artists a platform so they can, you can see them in a light in which you've never seen before.
Right. So what, as you were, how long has this project been sitting with you?
Well, it took 10 years to finish. So
oh, wow. Okay.
I had dreamed it up for many years before that. But when I thought about making it, I wasn't actually a filmmaker back then. So I thought it was too daunting. Specifically in terms of the clearances, because we do have some very high profile artists in the show. And of course, the music is, I treat it as a character in the show, and I didn't want to compromise that. So there's a lot of music. We had like 56 cues in our show. And that was very important, though, treating the music as a character, because it really is the underpinning, right? It's the score of our lives from the 70s. And it also demonstrates sort of the journey of a people. So I was sort of matching the journey of the music with the journey of the culture and that sort of visual journey. So a lot of intentionality around, you know, sort of collapsing three stories into one and trying to make it as complex as life and Black lives can be.
When you brought this project to your family and told your family, this is what I'm going to do, what was your family's reaction to showcasing your uncle's story?
I think they were excited and a little hesitant,
yeah.
as many families can be, because what was really important to me was that this is really the story, not just of a people and a culture and music, but it's also the story of a man and his unique personality, his unique aesthetic, and what he could bring to the show that would put his own personal stamp on it. And so that was, that meant some delving into the origin, sort of the origin story of Ellis Haslip, which is somewhat of an exposure, you know, for the family. But there had always been immense pride in Ellis and the work that he did. Also, though, he's a, you know, it's very important to say that he was a queer individual, which is so key, because he's kind of an underdog. And for that matter, there aren't a lot of Black gay icons as well. And I think it's important that we hold them up right now. Past, present, and future. And so, you know, there was a little trepidation around what I would share, what I would expose. But for the most part, it was the universal reaction was, well, that's long overdue. I think everybody kind of expected, because of the company he was keeping and the caliber of that company, that it would have been done by now. Even I thought that. I thought, somebody's going to do this documentary. Are you kidding me? It's, I always imagined it might be a series, because there were 130 episodes and each one delved so deeply and completely into a theme or an artist. There's just so much material.
Oh, I can imagine.
It's really hard to choose.
What was a piece of information that you learned about your uncle that you had never heard before that just really shined for you?
I think what really shone for me was his, Ellis Haslip's ability to walk on this line. I think he really experienced a duality in a way. As a Black queer man in the 60s and 70s, you know, it's hard enough to be Black in America, let alone Black and queer, and still try, knowing that you have an agenda and knowing that you want to, you know, push the culture forward. I was surprised to learn that he was so devoted to institution building. I knew that he believed in individuals, and I knew that he could see artists in a way or in a certain light that they didn't see themselves. So he could always offer the next step for them or the next great opportunity. But I didn't know until I started talking to someone, several people that I interviewed and 10 years of research, was the depth to which he went to try to establish, maintain, and push forward these Black institutions. this notion that Black art didn't have a platform or wasn't significant enough to warrant an institution was outrageous to him. And so when I would speak to people and they would say, oh, no, he was my first board member. Or did you know that he took Alvin Ailey on tour when Alvin Ailey only had six dancers? Or did you know that he helped to expand the footprint of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, which is also the New York Public Library? I wasn't aware of all of these things because I saw him as somewhat of an impresario and a, you know, a cultural leader. But I didn't know that he was working with the Congressional Black Caucus. I didn't know that he was going to Sing Sing and recording art, recording albums with the inmates. I didn't know that he was always had a broader vision of what the arts could be and how the arts could impact communities, and especially communities of color. That was amazing to me because he, you know, he would drop into these wonderful moments, like after Soul, you know, he produced Michael Jackson's 21st birthday party at Studio 54. And I'm thinking, what? You're telling me that you knew Michael Jackson. Hang on a second. Where was I? Hey, I was probably too young to get into Studio 54, but that would have been nice.
Yeah.
So it was really surprising to me, and also to know the depth of the relationships that he had with people at a time when we didn't have social media, we didn't have access to people the way we do now. You know, you can slide into their DMs or do whatever it is you have to do. It was a different culture then, and that was a huge surprise to me. And again and again and again, no matter who with whom I spoke, that's when I realized that the currency that he yielded was relationships and trust.
Yeah.
And you see that, you see that intimacy that he just was, he had these relationships that yielded such intimate moments with people on camera where people were completely unselfconscious.
Yeah.
And today we have so much at stake, whether we're, you know, talking about a movie or we're out there clout chasing, whatever we're doing to get people's attention.
Yeah.
That's not what this show was about. The show was about, there's already something going on. We're going to let you drop in and watch, but there's already a renaissance happening. There's already Black excellence. There's already a reaffirmation of Black culture at large.
Yeah. It seemed like I'm sorry. It seemed like his show was so much more involved in the broader discourse. It was so discussion focused, and the ties that he has for with the poetry and the dance, everything had just had a broader meaning to it. He was making this. Now I'm getting lost in my words, but
no, I'm saying it's because it was a showcase that was such a range of Black creativity that you don't normally see.
Yeah,
and all of it accepted at the same level, so nothing was more important. You had activists on there, but you also had performers, singers and dancers, leaders of the Black Panthers.
Yeah.
Kwame Ture was on there, and so was Kathleen Cleaver. But then you turn around and you have Patti LaBelle and Arsenio Hall doing magic tricks. You know, so everything was just as important. He never singled anyone out or made anyone feel more famous than the next. It was unpredictable, and it was quirky, and it was just as popular as Stevie Wonder and just as obscure at the time as Rahsaan Roland Kirk or Thelonious Monk. I don't have the footage of Monk on the show. He was very reclusive, but to think that there he was with his son on the drums, T.S. Monk, that's just remarkable. Yeah. And some of the earlier episodes have been lost, but there's documentation of them. And that kind of breath and that kind of sort of curating the culture is another level. And it's really inspiring to see it now that we are so advanced, supposedly, and we're supposed to, everything's supposed to be accessible. What he accessed was something a lot less tangible. And that was like truth, the truth and beauty of Black culture, and which is universal. Everyone can relate to that. You know, it wasn't just a Black show. It was about soul, and we all have that.
Yeah, and
so I love about the film is that it's really universal. Everybody connects to it on some level.
And I appreciated, again, it's just speaking to that. There's nothing that was on TV at that point, and there's not that even to like today. We're even farther removed from that type of program. But what was brought to air, the content was brought to air almost, there's probably a better phrase to say it, with warts and all, but there's this slight imperfection, like when he gave the wrong title to the poetry piece that hit air. There's just those moments of levity and those moments of just awareness, I guess, just to be like, I made a mistake. Let's move on. We don't need to cut. We don't need to retake that.
Sure. And even in that introduction, because that was an incredible show. It was the Last Poets performing on the, I believe it was October 24th, 1968. So it was very early on in the series, and it was literally the fifth episode. And the fact that he would have the audacity to put the Last Poets on there.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no, this is pre-FCC. There's no 7-second delay. And so you're just going to get what you're going to get. But the way he introduces them, he says, I hope you'll accept it in the spirit in which it's been given, in which it's intended. And so that lets you set back and say, okay, hang on a second. We're about to see something really subversive, but there's probably some great intentions behind it. Let's see if we can stay open. And I know that the phone boards lit up that night, and they probably should have been canceled. So early on, but that was what he was always doing. He was pushing the boundaries of what was acceptable, and certainly for Black people to think about what was acceptable thought about themselves, you know, and what trying to change Black people's minds about themselves and change the world about Black people. So in a way, we were all changing.
Yeah, I like the line. I think it's near the beginning of the film where it was described that the white community was learning something new about the Black experience every night. I just thought that was a really stunning statement to make. And again, it's so frustrating that there's nothing like that. There's nothing like soul on TV right now.
Well, I hope that maybe that with this, you know, I feel like this show, because it's only an hour and a half long, it's really like the gateway drug into the soul episodes. Luckily, there's been a resurgence of some of the episodes. Like, you can watch some on Amazon Prime now.
Oh,
there's
can
like
you?
24 episodes there, which is really cool. A lot of folks have that. Or there's a kind of funky retro site called Shout Factory TV, and they have about 25 or so episodes. But I'm hoping that this will reinvigorate a conversation around bringing this show back, because it was made for the people by the people. And it was supposed to be on public television anyway. You know, this is all TSOD, transactional streaming on demand and all of that. But it was before all of that. It was the notion that this is for you. This is by us, for us, but it's also for everyone. But I think what was really important is, and what I'll say, you know, mostly about the show and what Ellis Haslip knew, is that he was positioning this show to really showcase the Black arts movement and as it was emerging. And even though that era is kind of done, I still think that we are still emerging culturally, and that if we can sort of come together and find our allies, you know, this could be a new awakening when you think about it.
I hope so.
It really could be. Yeah, it's a time that is a very interesting time, very challenging time, but I also think that it's rife with possibilities. Mm-hmm. You know, with all due respect to everyone who has been challenged or lost their lives during the pandemic, you know, of course.
I really appreciated the moments when we got to see Ellis's personality behind the camera, particularly when one of your subjects recounts a story where Ellis had claimed to have had an affair with many famous icons, including including the Dalai Lama, I think, was in there. And he responds like, "Don't you know that I lie?" I guess my question is, knowing that about your uncle, I'm curious, given his tendency to exaggerate, How did you go about finding the fact from the fiction while researching this film? Did you run into that a lot?
Oh, yes. And we devoted an entire chapter of the film and called it, you know, Ellis the Trickster.
Yeah.
Because we knew that the tricks, the jokes, the stories, you know, he had a very, very interesting relationship with the truth.
Yeah.
And so I think part of that was this notion of always remaking himself and always finding a new, almost like he had to keep evolving as a person just to get his story out there because of the limitations of the time. We have to remember the limitations of Jim Crow, and having grown up in a segregated part of Washington, D.C., Ellis knew what his limitations were. And I think he always wanted more room. That was a theme with him. And not just as a on a personal level, but this idea of more room for the culture, more room to express himself and to give artists a platform to express themselves. And I think he knew the power of television, even though it was still young at the time, and this idea that you could create a platform that exponentially would reach more people. And that excited him very much.
Absolutely. So as you're making a documentary, you said you've been working on this for 10 years. I like talking to documentary filmmakers, and I like asking, what's something that you were watching or reading that inspired the vision of this film? Well, I guess what I'm asking, what extended reading materials or extended viewing materials to go along with this feature?
Oh, there are so many. Basically, I wanted to make sure I knew every single book and every single article that mentioned Ellis Haslip, because there were so few publications that would justify a show like this until recently, because it wasn't taken very seriously. It was considered a variety show, or some folks called it the Black Tonight Show. And so the idea that this show was really significant only came to pass after a lot of time had gone by. And I had to read up so much on not just the era, but what was happening in the country that would have created an opportunity for a show like this. What was going on such that there were so few Black shows on television, and also, of course, negative stereotypes and the way the media was weaponized toward the inhumanity of African Americans. And I had to see, to be fair and without judgment, to understand what an impact Soul would make. So I read a lot about public television and the birth of public television and the National Broadcast Act and how that came together at that time and created the sort of PBS system. I read a lot about what they call the boob tube and how people felt like it wasn't doing the job it was meant to do, and why the mandate of public television came to be as a way of educational television versus entertainment television. That was interesting. Then I started to read up about the Black Arts Movement and who the leaders were during that time. I read everything that was sort of Black history connected, sort of intersectionality, you know, and trying to find connections between the Black Arts Movement, the Civil Rights Movement, the Women's Movement, and the anti-Vietnam War movement, and how all those pivoted together and converged in a way to give birth to or give rise to a show like Soul. So I had to understand what made Soul necessary in order to understand why it ended up being significant. Because not only was it a vehicle for African-American artistry, but we have to remember it was a platform for political expression and the fight for social justice. And that was not the model we knew. You know, that was not the Tonight Show model where, sympathetic host comes out, tells a few jokes, sits down, invites some guests, and you call it a day.
Yeah.
We have to remember how severely the, segregation and Jim Crow impacted our culture and our country, such that there was a blind eye turned to people of color. So you're not only pushing back against history, but you're pushing back for validation just to exist. So how do you take all of that and then package it and make a show that is inviting to people and that's not exclusionary? And so I read up a lot about the history of Jim Crow and the history of the beginning of television especially. And I read a lot of works by the artists in the show, biographies of James Baldwin, poetry volumes by all folks in the arts. And yeah, I took a deep dive into everything and it never ended. Yeah, you know, sure. Every week it was a new package from Amazon. And then I was excited to see that there were scholars who were starting to base their work on this time period and sort of the birth of Black Power television, as they called it. Mm-hmm. And that was interesting too. And so I brought them on to be our academic advisors to help us figure out what the intellectual spine would be, mm-hmm. because we were asking for grants from nonprofit organizations and foundations that had to find a historical significance in order to fund you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, major grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts. And so it had to fit that sort of public television mandate to be, and it was tough because our film was not based on a Pulitzer Prize winning historical novel that had already been done and that was already lined up for a platform like American Masters or, mm-hmm. or you know, something like that. So we were starting from scratch with an idea that hadn't been vetted. And I was not famous and I didn't have a track record. So all those things were against me. And so I had to make sure that I was well educated and knew the lay of the land, if you will, but certainly the background of what we were doing.
Yeah.
Very important.
Yeah. Again, I just enjoyed this documentary so much and I just found it to be so insightful and incredible. Since I asked you before how your family's reaction was as you announced that you were making it, what's their reaction since the film has been released?
Oh, they're absolutely thrilled. The family is so thrilled because for them, it's a personal legacy.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's true for sure. And it's important to be able to have that legacy and to explore it further. But they also realize that this is a bigger story. You know, we're all standing on the giant, on the shoulders of giants in one way or another, but this is a larger story. This is the story of America, and Black history is American history. And so it's nice to be a part of that and to have lived through it and still find ways to make it enlightening. Mm-hmm. So the family's really happy now, I think. You know, at first they were worried that I was biting off much more than I could chew, mm-hmm. which was accurate. That's fair. And then they're like, well, thank goodness you did that, mm-hmm. because so many of our great African-American icons are leaving us now. You know, mm-hmm. we lost Bill Withers and McCoy Tyner in the same month.
Yeah.
And they happen to be on the same episode of Soul. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty remarkable. And so in a way, it is a time capsule from before, but we're also capturing this generation. Mm-hmm. And that's really key. And next generation, because, you know, Questlove's in there too. Mm-hmm. And it was important to not make it just a look back, but to have it speak to our future.
Thank you again, Melissa, so much for the film. And I'm so glad that even during a pandemic that we're given this virtual option to see the film. I couldn't have waited any longer. Let me just say that. I would have liked to see it in a theater, but I'm just glad that we had this opportunity.
Well, actually, I'm glad you mentioned that because if you're in Michigan, it will be screening at a drive-in.
Will it really?
Oh. Yes. And it's very, I'm going to pull that up for you. The idea was to give folks all over the country a chance to see it in virtual cinemas.
Yeah.
And to also, the easy way to do that is just to go to our website, MrSoulMovie.com, and you just go to the screenings tab, and then you'll see a whole list of theaters across the nation. And you can pick a theater that you that you'd like to support, or maybe your favorite local theater, mm-hmm. and just click on that. And then you'll see that costs like $12 to watch the movie and you have 72 hours or you have a week. Mm-hmm. It's very easy. Mm-hmm. But the idea is to give people a way to see it at home now when we really need inspiration now more than ever.
Yeah.
And since we're social distancing, we were able to to get a couple of drive-ins. Now, I wish I could go to the one in Detroit. Oh, I know it's going to be fantastic.
I live. I've already gone to that drive-in a couple times this summer. I love that drive-in. It's about a 30-minute drive for me. I'm definitely going to go check it out there. It'd be so fun to see it with an audience.
Oh, I can't imagine. I wish I could drive. I don't know how long the drive is from New York to Detroit, but I would definitely be there in a heartbeat.
There are parts of the film where I wanted to get up and just dance in my living room watching it. I just want to get out of my car and be able to socially distance dance with people with an audience driving. Yeah.
For sure. So yeah, check that out. There will be a couple of drive-ins because we're just trying to be mindful of the pandemic, and we are happy to screen virtually. We want everybody to be safe, but we also want to give people a chance to celebrate. And if you can find room to find joy right now, you know, that's what we're all about. And that's really very important.
Well, again, thank you so much, Melissa, for giving me your time to record this.
Thank you for having me. And be sure to follow us at Mr. Soul the Movie on all the platforms so that you can keep up with all the new screenings. There might be some new ones popping up.
So Mr. Soul, is it just at Mr. Soul on social media?
It's at Mr. Soul the Movie on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And then the website is MrSoulMovie.com. That has all the screening information on there.
Perfect. Perfect. Thank you again for giving us your time. And have a great evening and best of luck promoting and touring the film.
Thank you so much, Michigan. I love you guys.
That was Melissa Hazelip. Again, as I said at the top of this episode, I think that's my favorite interview I've ever done for this show. And just because she was such an intellectually fascinating human being. And so much of this episode was me listening because I was afraid to interrupt the brilliance that was coming from the other side of the computer. So thank you again to Melissa for giving me her part of her very busy schedule to record this episode. Be sure to check out Mr. Soul and the Michigan Theater's virtual movie palace. Just go to michtheater.org/screenings. Follow the Michigan and State Theater on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can find the Michigan Theater at Michigan Theater, the State Theater at State Theater A2. And of course, you can email the podcast at btmpod@gmail.com. Send me your movie magic moments. Send me anything that's on your mind. I love to hear from you. Thank you to the Ann Arbor District Library for posting this episode on Apple Podcasts. Be sure to rate and subscribe if you have not done so yet already. Matt is still helping me from afar to do this, so I thank him for his support as well. Coming up, we're going to have another episode next week. Next week is going to be my interview with Kevin Smokler and Christopher Boone. They are the directors of the film Vinyl Nation. That's also available today. And you can even join this next episode. We'll be recording it live on Facebook Wednesday, September 2nd at 7 p.m. Just hop on there. That's where I'll be talking with Kevin and Chris. You can send in your questions. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Kevin is from Ann Arbor, actually, and the two of them together, they just make a dynamic duo. You can see on the Vinyl Nation page on the Michigan Theater website an introduction that they did for the film, and you can just see that they have a chemistry that will be a lot of fun to play around with. So I hope you're looking forward to that as much as I am. So thanks for listening this week. Have a terrific weekend. Stay safe. And thank you for joining us behind the marquee.